Today, from the Wings Archive, the powerful conclusion of Marilyn French's speech, Beyond Power.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today you will hear part two of two half-hour programs on author Marilyn French, recorded at the First World Summit on Women and the Many Dimensions of Power in Montreal, Quebec. Marilyn French's talk was based on her book Beyond Power, on Women, Men, and Morals. Marilyn French.
It has been shown that companies which insist on extremely rigorous control of employees, on purposeful obfuscation and internal spying to maintain control, tend to be less efficient than others. Yet if this is pointed out, they do not change their systems. They want the appearance, the illusion of control, more than they want efficiency, productivity, or harmony. Governments that worship control, and all of them do, are fond of parading weapons and soldiers, instruments of control. Monarchs and leaders require formal displays of attention by underlings, mainly because such displays inspire fear, which increases control. We call historical figures great, like Alexander, because they controlled large territories or numbers of people. Degree of control, a quantitative criterion, is what impresses the world. The qualitative effects of the domination of an Alexander, a Genghis Khan, a Napoleon, a Bismarck, what they did to people and human well-being, are not considered worth mentioning. Such men are great because they possessed great amounts of control. We're already beginning to see a revision in attitude toward men like Hitler and Stalin, who in time will take their place in history as great men. The values of the political realm are the values of the private realm. A man raised to believe manhood consists of control will willingly sacrifice intimacy, love, and trust between himself and his wife in order to demonstrate to himself, to her, and to other people that he holds her in subjection. A woman raised to believe manhood consists of control and womanhood of submission will subordinate herself to her husband, but in time turn bitterly against him because, of course, in fact, he's not in control. He cannot be. He's but a puny, as Joyce put it in Finnegan's Wake, a human being. All this began thousands of years ago, after men discovered they had a part in the miracle of producing children. Some interpreted their role in procreation to mean they had transcendent powers. Men's self-definition changed. No longer marginal beings, less necessary than women to the life of the group, but freer, with more chance to play and roam, they decreed themselves transcendent. They could impregnate women without suffering pregnancy, parturition, the responsibility of nursing. They had miraculous powers like women's, but they were not tied to the necessary as women were. And this division penetrates our culture right straight through. You can trace a line. Remember Aristotle distinguishing between citizen men who lived a life of volition, choice, freedom, and those bound to necessity, all women, slaves, and mechanics, that is, men who had to work with their hands, men who did not own property. Like the transcendent gods they worshipped, men could affect a situation without being affected by it. Men were closer than women to Godhead. Men were beings with control. With this self-definition, patriarchy was born. The new ideas took centuries, perhaps millennia, to take hold, and they took hold at different times in different parts of the planet. One of the reasons it took so long is men themselves probably fought against these ideas. If a man defines himself as a controller, he must sever himself from everything that might tempt him to give up control. He must sacrifice mutual trust, mutual love, fellowship, intimacy, and adopt constant guardedness, an unremitting stance of power over. Many men were probably reluctant to give up felicity for something as impalpable as status. And women fought actively against the new religion. Myths and tales in the Old Testament, in Greek literature, in cultures as disparate as the Babylonians, the Aztecs, the Norse, a host of African societies, suggest a long struggle between adherents of matricentric and patriarchal ideas. The vanguard of patriarchy was probably the priesthood, men enchanted with the idea of power, who worked to establish the new belief. Their major task was to break men's tie to women. They did this by casting contempt upon the realm of nature as the root of pain, death, and filth, and by insisting on women's ancient association with nature. Only a realm superior to nature was worthy, the realm of God. The attributes of God were power and control. Domination was divine. Men were real men only to the degree to which they shared divine characteristics. Thus, men had a divine right to dominate women, and almost every society from the beginning of patriarchy has, in some way in its laws, granted men the right to beat women, or even kill them in many cases. Priests worked to change customs so that children would be named for their fathers rather than their mothers, previously the only parent, and to pass on private property in a male line. To name children for their fathers, and even more to make them his heirs, requires that men be sure which children they father. And such assurance requires that women be sexually regulated and constricted. Priests urged men to force their wives to join their husbands' families at marriage instead of the reverse. Now, this is a huge difference. If when you marry, your husband comes to live with you and your mother and your aunts and your uncles and whoever, your husband is much less likely to beat you, much less likely to try to oppress you than if you go live with him and his people. Also, if you go live with him and his people, you are entirely isolated. You may be the only person there from your own tribe. You may even be the only one who speaks your language. This broke down female solidarity. Finally, the priests posited a bond between father and child that transcended the bond of love between mother and child. It was a bond of power and required child sacrifice. Child sacrifice was practiced in Israel as late as Jeremiah, who inveighs against it. The story of Abraham and Isaac probably reflects a modification of the practice. It was also practiced in many other places. Patriarchy was a moral revolution waged by men against women. Its laws and its literature transformed nature from a primarily benevolent realm into a slough of filth and vileness, a realm of flux and uncertainty to be approached warily, controlled when possible, and made safe only by priestly intervention. And women were part of nature. Consider the central chapters of Leviticus. I'm concentrating on the Old Testament because it's such an important book for us, and also because it's one of the early books that has all this. The rules on what you put in your mouth. First of all, the book of Leviticus is entirely directed at men. The rules on what you put in your mouth are right next door to the rules on what you put your penis into. Rules on eating and rules on sex are the same. Men could not avoid being depraved by nature since they emerged from women's bodies, although certain men escaped the general curse by having a cesarean delivery. It seems the vaginal canal is more polluted than the womb. You may remember that Macduff could kill Macbeth because he was not born of woman. He had a cesarean delivery. Men who obeyed the god could raise themselves above the general curse. Women were of a different species from men. Under the rule of nature, they were inferior, mutilated, Aristotle called them, mutilated men, bound to the realm of the necessary. We don't know with certainty or where or when patriarchy first emerged. The area around Sumer in Mesopotamia seems a good candidate in the third and fourth millennia before the Common Era, a likely time. It spread slowly at first, probably in patches, but then it became a flood sweeping through the Middle East over centuries of hideously bloody wars that historians now call the cult of frightfulness. Among the novelties that patriarchy brought with it were the notion of adultery, which first appears now in law codes. It's a crime only women can commit. War and slavery. The Sumerian word amargi came to mean freedom, but its roots are back to the mother. Patriarchy was ugly, but it was victorious, because patriarchal thinking is contagious. Say you live in a small, peace-loving state, content with the crops you raise, the affection of your family and neighbors, and with your sense that you matter to others. But bordering your state is another ruled by patriarchists who believe in those crucial words, fame and glory, translatable into power and control. To increase its fame and glory, the neighboring state prepares to invade yours. You have only two choices. You can surrender and learn to your pain, as your men and boys are all killed, your women enslaved, and your fine crops requisitioned for opulent and wasteful patriarchal banquets, while your children starve. That power is the highest value. Or you can muster an army, train your people to fight and kill, trade your crops for weapons, waste your land and theirs, and learn to your pain that power is the highest value. In either case, you've been converted. The great irony is that even as patriarchy teaches that power is the highest value, it demands fear and obedience. It asserts that men are gods, but requires them to kneel. The invention of a transcendent God was only the first stratification. It postulated an intelligent power superior to men, lacking human vulnerabilities. All other stratifications follow from this one, and each makes similar postulations. One group, being derived from a God, is superior to all others and lacks their vulnerabilities. All men are superior to all women and lack female vulnerabilities. White or yellow is superior to black, red, yellow, or white. Such claims will be backed up by prejudicial laws and economic arrangements, which help to make it fact. For indeed, the superior group does lack vulnerabilities suffered by others. Swiftly, certain ethnic backgrounds or religions become superior to others. Employers are superior to employees. The rich are superior to the poor, and some rich people are better than others. Patriarchy invented hierarchy, a structure designed to maintain and transmit power, and consider the root of that word, which is hiero, which means priest. In imitation of female powers, the ability to conceive passed only from mother to daughter. Hierarchy arranges for the passing of a mantle of power from spiritual father to spiritual son, and claims greater importance and significance than any mere natural power. In actuality, very few men are offered the opportunity to command. Most live and die at the lower end of hierarchies. But in return for fear and obedience, which may be called deference, or nowadays we call it, in our democratic times, fitting in. All men, even the lowest on the ladder, are granted superiority over women. In order for hierarchical claims to appear to be based on reality, however, women must be totally excluded from institutions. And so they were until the rise of the second wave of the feminist movement 20-odd years ago. Women have been protesting about the way the world is run and their exclusion from power in writing, at least since the 14th century, since Christine de Pizan. Since the 18th century, they've been protesting on grounds of human rights. And they have gained access to some power seats within some institutions. But their gains come slowly and are impeded at every step by both the conscious will and the unconscious fears of men. For men's self-definition is factitious. It is a lie, and all men know this, at least about themselves. Men are not, nor can they be, in control even of themselves at all times. Men's control over others may be enormous, but so fragile is power that it collapses in a moment. Consider the Shah of Iran, Nixon, Duvalier, Marcos, and recent events in Eastern Europe. Power is not a substance. It's not something you can hold in your hands like a scepter. It's a delicate relation, a dynamic interaction. Men's power over nature has increased enormously since patriarchy began, but it's illusory. It leads to unforeseen and terrifying consequences we're not sure we can control, like acid rain or the greenhouse effect. Men have for millennia created legal structures forcing women into inferiority, dependent upon men physically, economically, and politically. Something, by the way, they would not have had to do if women were inferior by nature, as they claim. And patriarchy did place some responsibilities on men. Yet despite all these controls, at no time have men ever felt in control of women. And their fear of hatred of women continue. The country of Brazil has very strict laws and customs governing women who have very few rights, whatever. Most middle-class women, anyway, are locked in the home, completely dependent on their husbands. Some years ago, a so-called feminist, I don't think we'd call it feminist, but a women's television program was started. And one day a week they had a male lawyer, because of course there were only male lawyers then, appear to answer questions from the women who watched, and his bag exploded every week, and something like 3/4 of the questions were about what they could do about their husbands beating them. Nothing removes male fear and hatred of women except the admission by men to themselves, to other men, to women, that they are not in control, do not need to be in control, to be human, to be men. The Industrial Revolution and the technological one that followed it have raised to astonishing heights human control over nature and seem to confirm our self-definition. In hubris only dreamed of by the Greeks who coined the term, we have in this century flown above the earth and sailed beneath the sea. We have touched down on the moon and spread earthly debris through space. History, if there is a history after this millennium, will remember these things. But it will also remember the murder of several million Congolese, the near eradication of the Jews, the dropping of nuclear bombs over highly populated cities, and the invention of a new form of government, totalitarianism. With each technical advance, we diminish further the old matricentric values that enabled our species to survive to the present. Bonds of affection, community, sharing, and love are impediments to self-realization, to individuality. We view procreation and child rearing with contempt. They're mere animal acts. And we have arranged the world in such a way that it is almost impossible for a woman to give birth to a child and manage to support it by herself. Since the 16th century, male-dominated societies have decreed that women are supposed to be dependent on men. No cognizance is taken of the fact that many men do not support their children or mates, or that not all women have men upon whom they can depend. There are more women than men in the world, and many men do not choose to be involved with women. As a result, women and children have, since the beginning of capitalism, comprised most of the poor and now make up 4/5 of the poorest class in the United States and equally large proportions elsewhere. And we still worship power. We continue to imagine that expanded control can solve all social and economic problems. Rulers of states across the globe still reach first for weapons rather than diplomacy. Maybe we're seeing a change in this. In defiance of all wisdom and even common sense, rulers of the great powers continue to amass nuclear weapons as if these symbols of power could save them. So too, we in our ordinary lives continue to imagine that the solution to our problems is more control, more power, more money. This idolatry, this blind worship of power, this superstitious belief that more of it will somehow save us, is the major impediment to any beneficial change, not just in international relations, but in personal relations, not just in political life, but in institutional and in private life. We must find ways to break the hold of patriarchal values upon our imaginations. Although patriarchal attitudes are unjust to women, to people of color, to subordinate men, one could understand elite men wanting them, fighting to retain them, if they brought them joy and well-being. They don't. The pursuit of power is never ending and never satisfying. You never have enough. And domination is isolation. It means living in constant fear of overthrow. Most men, in fact, have little power and cling superstitiously to emblems and appearances as if, were they to give them up, they would cease to be men, would become like women, would be women. The most horrifying thought to men, trained as they are, and as we are, to despise women. Men are not alone in worshiping power. Women, too, believe what they're taught, and all of us have been taught that power is the greatest good, that the mind, the abstract, the abstruse are purer and higher than those old devils, sex, emotion, and the flesh. But men's self-definition as controllers is the rock upon which patriarchy is founded, the rock on which the entire planet may founder. For if men did not have to be superior simply to be, then none of us would have to be superior simply to be. We could be what we are, humans together, subject to the trauma of birth and the fear of death, to pain and loneliness, disease and loss, ecstasy and pleasure. We could accept our vulnerability, which would allow us to feel it, and that in turn would help us to feel what we have to deny when we try to be invulnerable, transcendent, masculine, impregnable, consider the root of that word. And women as well as men make such an effort. In one of the early Christian Gospels, which was put aside by the Church Fathers when they compiled the New Testament, the Gospels called the Gnostic Gospels, Thomas asks Jesus, "May women enter the life," capital T, capital L, Master. And he says, "They shall if they shall make themselves male." And people like Margaret Thatcher have taken him at his word. If we could accept ourselves as participants in a magnificent universe, fragile, tender, enduring, tough, talkative, gossipy, nasty, selfish, humorous, sweet, intelligent, passionate creatures who are, unlike other animals, capable of symbolic thought, and therefore, unlike other animals, capable of deluding ourselves, if we could accept ourselves as we are, we could start to build a morality based on actual human needs and desires. There is still time, we have to believe that, to change our lives. We have to overcome a great deal, our own superstitious or religious faith in power, our suicidal self-hatred, the product of millennia of patriarchal training, our need to be more than we are. Each major patriarchal age has taught us that we are vile and must transcend ourselves. Jehovah says to Noah in the book of Genesis, "The imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth." Christianity teaches that all of us are tainted from birth by original sin and require priestly intervention as well as constant effort not to slide into our natural depravity. Capitalism for centuries has defined man as aggressive, savage, greedy, depraved, and self-seeking. And totalitarian states so hate human nature that they try to remake it entirely by force. But we cannot simply assert the old definitions are false. We can't just reject patriarchy. We must approach the future positively and replace power by a positive value. There is really only one thing worth living for: pleasure. Patriarchies condemn pleasure, call it unworthy, frivolous, selfish. But consider what gives you the greatest pleasure in your life, and you will probably discover it is deeply serious. We get pleasure from our abilities, power to rather than power over, good work, especially when it's appreciated by others, easy, trusting being together with a community of friends and lovers, feeling part of something larger than yourself, feeling that you matter. We enjoy nature and art, spontaneity and play, using our bodies. The core of pleasure, I call it the sacred core, is mutuality. Joys in which one act pleases two. Feeding and being fed. Holding and being held. Loving and being loved. These are universal goods. They are essential to the survival of an infant and to the survival of a society. Power is contagious, but so is pleasure. Pleasure has been condemned by patriarchy because it is one part of life that cannot be controlled. Pleasure arises from freedom and creates freedom. Governments can force us to work or keep us from working. They can restrict the kind of work we do. They can enslave us. They can transport us to Manchuria and force us to spend the rest of our lives building a great wall. They can impress us into military service and force us to kill. They can force feed us when we wish to fast or starve us when we want food. They can control what we read, write, and publish. In the Soviet Union, it is illegal to own a mimeograph machine. Even in ancient times, rulers strictly controlled what people said about them. But no power can force you to feel pleasure. A life dedicated to pleasure is a life dedicated to freedom. Can we afford to resign ourselves to letting the power lovers choose our future? If we do, we know where we're headed. Thank you.
You've been listening to part two of 2 half-hour programs recorded in Montreal, Quebec, June 6, 1990, at the First World Summit on Women and the Many Dimensions of Power. Marilyn French was the luncheon speaker. She presented her paper to an attentive crowd in the Grand Salon Room of the Hotel Meridian. For Wings, I'm Catherine Davenport.
Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. You can find many Wings programs, old and new, by visiting our website wings.org. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.